The state Supreme Court halts the resentencing hearing for a former teacher who raped a 14-year-old student. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us why more Montana high school students are taking the ACT college entrance exam. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with a clean energy advocate about why the U.S. is falling behind other countries in the development of clean energy. Montana Supreme Court has ordered a judge to cancel today's resentencing hearing for a former teacher who got 30 days in prison for raping a 14-year-old student. Justices say Judge G. Todd Baugh does not have authority to reconsider the sentence he gave to former Billings teacher Stacey Rambold. Baugh appeared in his courtroom today shortly after the hearing was scheduled to begin. He told a group of reporters and observers that he decided he could not resentence Rambold even before the Supreme Court intervened. Baugh was widely criticized for the August 26 sentencing for saying the victim was older than her chronological age. He has since sought to backtrack, apologizing for his comments and attempting to resentence Rambold. The Attorney General's office has appealed the case to the Supreme Court. Prosecutors contend Rambold must serve at least 2 years in prison. Rambold's defense attorney says the sentence was appropriate and can be undone only on appeal.
And another news from around the state, Montana high school juniors can now take the ACT college entrance exam free of charge. The Office of the Commissioner of Higher Education recently received a $28 million federal grant, and part of it is covering the cost of ACTs for the next 5 years. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce speaks with State Superintendent of Public Instruction Denise Juno, who says 9,000 students took the free ACTs last spring.
It's a great cost benefit to them because that test is about $50, and so it's a cost savings to families across the state. Prior to that, the ACT was given on weekends in larger cities, and so it was a great benefit to rural students because the test is now given on site at the school during the school day. It's an access and opportunity issue, really, and making sure that every student at least has the opportunity to attend college if they want to.
And having it free, it resulted in nearly 3,000 students took the test over those who had taken it last year.
Right. And so prior to universal ACT, we had probably about 65% of the graduating seniors of every class taking the ACT. And this time, because it was offered free for every junior, nearly 100% of those students took advantage of that. And so as a result of that, we saw about 820 more students eligible for the Governor's Best and Brightest Scholarship. Those students who may not have thought they were ready for college, now taking a test and finding that they had scores that were good enough to get them into the Montana University system. And the trend, I think, will continue where the more students that take the test, the more we'll be able to offer that to 100% of juniors, the more students we're going to see stepping into college and being ready for that. And so that's really exciting.
Offering the test for free is a part of your Graduation Matters initiative. Mm-hmm. Throughout your first term, you touted raising Montana's graduation rates a bit. How, moving forward into your second term, do you hope to build upon that success and increase that more?
Yeah, so everything that we do now is really under the umbrella of Graduation Matters Montana. When I first stepped into office, we saw about 2,000 students dropping out of school every year. It's way too many for the size and population of our state. And learned some lessons from different areas that were going around, different programs in the state, particularly in Missoula. They had Graduation Matters Missoula. We took those lessons, scaled them up statewide. And basically the components are schools work with your community, be truthful with your data around dropouts and graduation rates, pull small businesses in, Main Street businesses, and make them your partners, develop a plan and carry out that plan. And we would find ways at the state level to support those efforts. Since 2009, when the initiative started, we've actually seen the dropout rate decline from 5.1% to 4.1%, and the graduation rate increase from 80.7% to 83.9%. At the state level, we're more of a broker of best practices. Say if Anaconda wants to do a peer mentoring program, we connect them with Hardin, who has a great peer mentoring program, and so they learn from each other.
How else does Graduation Matters become a reality on the ground. What happens between a teacher or an administrator and that student who is on the edge of whether or not he or she graduates? What sort of concrete steps are taken to push that student a little bit further to finish them up?
Yeah, and we can look at best practices that are going on in schools around the state, and there are some great ones. We've been able to push through Graduation Matters the idea of including student voice at the school level, making sure that there's student engagement. I have a student advisory board that brings 40 students from different sized schools from across the state. Those include students who will be valedictorians of their class. They include students who have dropped out of school and dropped back in, who really advise me on the real life, the real world sorts of things that are going on the ground across the state, and basically how to help us develop state policy that might work. We were sitting around talking about dropout prevention. I said, you know, we've talked a lot about what principals can do and what teachers can do, but what is it that students can do? And they had this idea to create this I Pledge to Graduate campaign where students will fill out a card and say, I pledge to graduate. They write a because statement, and then they have it witnessed by a caring adult and someone who will hold them accountable to that pledge. And those I Pledge to Graduate events have happened all across the state. And for the most part, they are student-led. There's something that students engage in. They decide how it's going to play out in their school. There are now schools that are putting placing students on their school board so that they can have a voice in the types of policies that schools are creating. We've just seen a lot of great things come out as far as really asking students what's happening, a lot of student voice playing out as far as how school operates, the policies that play out, and really how to get more students engaged and therefore stay in school.
Superintendent of Public Instruction, Denise Juno, thank you so much for your time.
All right, thank you.
A $4.5 million federal grant will fund the lion's share of a bicycle trail stretching from Missoula to Lolo. Local cycling advocates have long wanted a safer cycling route between the two communities. Bike Walk Alliance for Missoula Vice President Jean Belongi Nye says the idea for such an ambitious project was sparked about 25 years ago after a young woman was critically injured in Lolo.
So what started out as a pathway through Lolo grew into the pathway down to Hamilton when they had all the Highway 93 focus stuff and everything. And we managed, Max Baucus managed to get us funding for that. But we couldn't get the Lolo to Missoula section onto that because that highway wasn't part of the construction. And so we started working and we worked and we had committees and we went to county commissioners and all of that. And then finally, it kind of disintegrated because people were just too busy.
Belongi Nye says the idea picked up another head of steam about 10 years ago. Several plans were created and refined, the necessary funds raised, and feasibility studies completed. Supporters got the word earlier this week that they'd won the very competitive $4.5 million federal transportation investment generating economic recovery grant.
The trail will run from Missoula to Blue Mountain on the west side of the highway. It'll cross at the light and run on the east side of the highway to Lolo and then cross back at Ridgeway and join the pathway. It has to meet federal standards. It has to be 10 feet wide. It can't be just a layer of asphalt. It's got to be several layers of under subsurfing, etc. And the process that we have to go through, we'll have to design it. Then we have to go through the permit process with NEPA and all of those types of environmental protection, etc. And then it'll go out to bid, and then construction will begin.
The Tiger Grant will be matched with city, county, and state funds, bringing the total budget to almost $5.5 million.
That's for bare bones. So we're going to start a capital campaign to raise $200,000. It would be for things possibly, you know, rest stops, landscaping, maybe alternatives. One of the two problems with just the way it's set up right now is the people in Hayes Creek, that area, don't have a safe access yet. So to run a kind of a side path down to Hayes Creek on the west side of the highway, making it very clear to people who are from out of town or whatever that this is going to be a dead end, and then running out to the Blue Mountain Recreation Area.
To critics who say this sounds like a lot of money for an 8-mile bicycle path, Blanji Nye says it's a steal given the number of lives that could potentially be saved on that busy highway, not to mention expensive medical care needed by those who could be injured in accidents.
And what our bicycle tourism brings into the state of Montana, our Missoula, they spend an average of $150 a day, and we had 8,500 bicyclists into Missoula last year, bicycle tourism. This is going to complete an incredible route. I mean, we're going to be able to go from Hamilton to Missoula, eventually from Missoula to Idaho. There are people in the Flathead who want to bring pathways down from Glacier. I mean, if we're going to do tourism, let's look at all types of tourism.
If all goes to plan, she says construction on the Missoula to Lolo path could start next summer and completed by 2015.
Clean energy advocates are closely watching the tax reform efforts in Congress and hoping that reform provides clear and helpful policies for clean energy development. Phyllis Cutdeneau is director of the Clean Energy Program for the Pew Charitable Trusts, one of those advocating for more clean energy development. In this feature interview, Cutdeneau talks with news director Sally Mock about the economic benefits of clean energy and how the U.S. is falling behind many other countries in its development. Cutdeneau has a lot of policy experience. She previously worked on the staffs of Washington Senator Brock Adams and California Senator Dianne Feinstein.
That certainly was a great education for me about how policy is made and compromise and working across the aisle and really kind of, you know, how the American public can affect policy.
Not all the American public feels they can.
Well, that's true. Things are certainly a little different now than they were when I was in the Senate. So I'm showing my age. But, you know, I still have confidence in our ability to impact policy and for Congress and the administration to work together and get things done. And I guess that's why I'm still working in the public policy arena, because I have faith in the system.
And that faith has been shaken, though, it sounds like, in recent years.
Any time where you have experienced an economic recession or downturn, there are things get a little bit harder. I think also that, you know, certainly, as you well know, media has played a role in really accelerating the rate at which we learn things and can impact and speak to others. And so I think, I think things are a little bit more complicated these days. But I think at the end of the day, most people that go to Washington and serve still have the nation's best interests at heart and really want to do the right things and represent their constituents. And so I think, we all have a role to play. So if you're someone that doesn't think that Washington's doing what you want them to do, everybody out there should write and call and visit and just speak up.
Let's talk now specifically about clean energy. And I guess the good news, isn't it, Phyllis, is that worldwide investment in clean energy is way up.
Well, we have seen a surge, absolutely, over the last decade in clean energy investment. Last year, we actually saw a little decline in clean energy investment, private investment, that is, to $269 billion. But that was really more a result of declining prices for clean energy technologies, because even though investment declined a bit, we still saw historic levels of clean energy deployment, 88 gigawatts in the last year alone. So that now there are more than 648 gigawatts of renewable energy capacity installed around the world, which is quite a bit more than, say, nuclear power, as a kind of a comparison. So, in a lot of places around the world, renewable energy is already the cheapest and best option. So it's very exciting. It's a big economic opportunity, particularly for the United States, when you think that we are the country that pioneered so many of these clean energy technologies. And if, the thing we need to do now is manufacture and export them around the world.
Because we are falling behind other countries in that arena, are we not? I mean, having led much of the innovation in clean energy development, translating that to clean energy actually being developed, we're lagging behind many other countries, are we not?
We are, sadly. For instance, since 2004, when we really began to track private investment globally, if you look at kind of the growth in the United States, was clearly the leader for several years. And then we have been jockeying for leadership back and forth with China and other countries. And on a variety of measurements, the United States is indeed falling behind, which you know, as you said, is very distressing when you consider that we have been the world's leader in these technologies. And, you know, it's just like any other technology that we have, say, whether or not it's the computer or, you know, other things. We really always want to be leading the world, but not only in innovation, but also in manufacture and export. And those are two of the places where we're really falling behind.
And the reasons for that, I suppose, are complex as well. But usually what's pointed to is the uncertainty of federal policy and tax policy and incentives in this country, that they're not as clear-cut as they should be and not in place in some cases.
That's absolutely right. You know, this country has in its past set clear goals when it comes to energy policy. We decided that, say, for instance, electricity was going to be cheap and universally accessible. So we have done things like that in the past, and we have certainly, when it comes to energy, supported emerging technologies, whether it was oil and gas extraction or nuclear power, you know, you name it. And so really what we're looking for now is just the same kind of treatment for clean energy technologies as we have extended to other technologies, incumbent technologies. And so that does include, for instance, certainty. As you mentioned, certainty is critical whether it comes to investing or deploying or developing, manufacturing these technologies. So when you have a production tax credit, say, that is on again, off again, episodic at best, investors just don't know what to do. You know, it really scares them off. And so what you find is these industries that have great potential are having struggling to find not only private capital, but also access to credit and really just plan and invest themselves. So what we're really asking for in kind of our work in Washington when it comes to public policy is that kind of certainty in the tax code, in the policy arena that will just help promote a more even playing field among technologies and help these companies really better compete and attract private investment.
There are many renewable energy advocates, Phyllis, who think that the imposition of a carbon tax would be a great boon to renewable energy development. Do you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. We, you know, frankly, I think different countries do different things in terms of their policy mechanisms. When we look around the world, and each year we study the private investment of clean energy in G20 nations, so our competitors really around the world, our colleague nations, and what we see is in every country that has steady, predictable policy in place, investment goes up. And so, you know, there's a great variety of different policy mechanisms that are used, whether or not they're feed-in tariffs or carbon policy or others. And so any of those mechanisms certainly could work here in the United States, but the real important kind of ingredient is that long-term predictability that allows growth. Because investors, as you well know, I hate to say it, but they're not particularly patriotic. They want to go where they are going to earn money for, you know, get a bang for their buck. And so that's where they will invest, where they have very steady, predictable policy that's going to lead to growth.
So a carbon tax would work.
Carbon tax could certainly be something, a policy that policymakers should look at.
How, if at all, do new projects that continue our development of fossil fuels suppress, if they do, renewable energy development? I'm thinking, for example, of the Keystone Pipeline, if that is approved and so on. Is that a hindrance or is that just irrelevant to whether renewable energy continues to be developed?
You know, I think when we think about renewable energy, a lot of times we're thinking about the utility sector in terms of wind or solar, combined heat and power efficiency, other things. You know, the pipeline is a kind of a very particular policy. But, you know, look, it would be misleading to say that the incumbent technologies have not led to growth in our nation that have been an economic engine. I think we're going to have a lot of them for a long time. The real question is, can we get to an even playing field among technologies in terms of policy treatment so that they can better compete with one another, so that consumers can make a decision about, you know, what they would like to consume. So I think anything that is going to increase competition and level the playing field, not tilt the playing field, you know, in the favor of the incumbents, but rather even it out, is good for the American consumer and is good for economic growth.
And it's far from even at this point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There have been incentives in the code, in the tax code, for renewable energy. But as I said, they've been very on again, off again. There are 4 permanent tax incentives in the code for incumbent technologies, some of which have been in place for 100 years. We're advocating that there is equal treatment among these different technologies, because after all, this shouldn't be a very political calculation. This is just a calculation of economics and technology.
As you know, our senior senator is heavily involved in drawing up the new tax reform legislation. I assume you'll be lobbying him.
Well, we are watching what Chairman Baucus is doing very closely. We're certainly talking to his office and other offices to try and press our case, to make our case. He seems to be moving very in a manner that's very comprehensive when it comes to tax reform. Both he and his counterpart on the House side, Chairman Camp of Ways and Means. And so I think that they are really trying to look at ways, both of them, to simplify the code, to streamline the code. And as you know, Chairman Baucus has asked his colleagues in the Senate to submit to him ideas for ways to do that, to simplify the code, but also for key incentives that need to remain in the code. I think there's a lot of thinking going on in the nation's capital about really how you could do that and what your priorities should be when it comes to the tax code. And we certainly hope that the chairman will be supportive. He certainly has been in the past. He helped to renew and write the policy that led to the extension of the production tax credit to 2013 for wind. Very important for the wind industry. And, of course, the wind industry is very important in Montana. So we hope that he is looking at this very carefully and will, of course, hear our concerns and others.
It's a pivotal time, isn't it, for the renewable energy field?
It is, absolutely. I think there is a lot at stake for this industry because the market for the industry is really growing in the United States, but also outside the United States. And without comprehensive energy policy or national energy policy, it's just very difficult for U.S. manufacturers, for U.S. companies, for U.S. entrepreneurs to compete, because the competition is stiff on the global market. Other countries and companies clearly, know that the size of the market is rapidly expanding, and they want a piece of it. And, they want it. These countries want it for all the same reasons we want it. We want to have our own sources of energy. We want to make sure that our sources of energy are cleaner. We want to make sure that we have an economic opportunity with our own domestic energy. So everybody's trying to move into this field, and we have real stiff competition not only from China but from Germany and others. And so there's a lot at stake, and we should be mindful of that, because the demand for energy that is growing outside the United States is really coming from developing countries. And again, these are places where clean energy in many cases are the cheapest and best option. It's analogous to the cell phone in Africa. Why are you going to build, a very complicated telephone pole structure, if you will, landline structure, when you can go to cell phones and cell towers? And that's a little bit like clean energy, when you can go to distributed power and you don't need to construct a big, big, big grid. So there's real opportunity outside the United States, and we've really got to seize it, because Montana has a renewable energy standard, and other states in our country do, but a collection of states cannot compete against China. We need a national energy a policy to compete against countries like China.
Well, I have been speaking with Phyllis Cudenau, who is director of the Pew Charitable Trust Clean Energy Program. Phyllis, thank you so much for your time. A really fun conversation about clean energy. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for spending the time with me. Good conversation and fun to have.
The Alternative Energy Resources Organization, Montana Renewable Energy Association, and the Pew Charitable Trusts are sponsoring a public forum and panel discussion on clean energy incentives Monday night at 5:30 in room L09 of the Gallagher Business Building on the University of Montana campus.
And now for tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide. Severe thunderstorm watch is in effect until 10 p.m. this evening for the Bitterroot Sapphire Mountains, the Butte Blackfoot region, and the Sealy Lake region. Tonight, expect rain showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds, small hail, and heavy rainfall. Lows will be in the mid-40s to lower 50s. Tomorrow and Sunday will be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms. Highs will be in the 70s. For central Montana, there is a severe thunderstorm watch in effect until 10 p.m. this evening. Tonight, expect showers and thunderstorms that may be severe with damaging winds, large hail, and heavy rainfall, with lows around 50 to 60 degrees. Tomorrow and Sunday calls for mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs around 65 to 75 degrees. And for southwest Montana, severe thunderstorm watch is in effect until 10 p.m. for Jefferson and Broadwater counties. Tonight, look for partly cloudy skies with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, and lows around 45 to 55 degrees. Tomorrow and Sunday will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs in the upper 70s. And now for the editorial comments of Patrick Barkey.
Someone wise in matters of politics once said that programs for the poor are poor programs. It remains true today. Initiatives aimed at helping the most vulnerable in our society, be they privately or publicly funded, seem to be perpetually starved for funds. And so the genius of those who created the Social Security system, originally aimed at older Americans whose assets were devastated by the Great Depression in 1935, was to make the program available to all, regardless of income. In a few short decades, the once prevalent stigma of being on the dole by receiving government checks was replaced by a feeling of ownership and entitlement, as all but a tiny fraction of Americans bought into the idea that the checks they received on green paper stock in the paper check days were earned through contributions paid during their working lives. That buy-in translated into broad political support for both Social Security and its close cousin, the Medicare program, instituted in 1965, that continues to this day. As a result, these are not poor programs by any stretch of the imagination. More than 51 million people benefited from the $1.3 trillion in old age survivors insurance, disability insurance, and Medicare funds dispensed this year. But the genius of design that helped these programs achieve such broad-based support also contains the seed of their demise, because their growth has changed the nature of government. In terms of dollars, the single most important task of federal government today is to transfer dollars from those of working age to those who have retired. No other activity, be it defense, education, roads, or parks, even comes close. And the commitment to do the same for decades to come has implications that are astonishing. We seem to be slow to wake up to that fact, yet awareness is growing. We still tend to kill the messengers who bring us this bad news. Fiscal cancer was the term used by the nation's then chief accountant, Comptroller General David Walker, when he spoke in Missoula 5 years ago about the crisis in entitlements. The analogy is apt. Like a dysfunctional organism, growth in the future liabilities for publicly funded health care entitlements in particular have been super-fueled as three powerful trends come together: increasing longevity, the growing numbers of baby boomer retirees, and the higher utilization rates of ever more complex and expensive health care technologies that have made total costs rise much faster than the economy in general and tax revenues in particular. The result is that the unfunded liability for the Medicare program alone, the amount of funds we'd have to collect and set aside today to pay for commitments we've made for the future retirees, is now five times larger than that for Social Security. The irony is that it could be the social welfare programs that are rich, and those unlucky enough to be working and hence taxed to pay for them that will be poor. Yes, this is an overstatement, but not as much as you might think. Because when you look at the numbers, as the Congressional Budget Office has, the changes needed to right the ship are big. Let's start with a working number, $900 billion. That's how much CBO estimates is needed to cut the gap between federal spending and tax revenues every year to get deficits on a sustainable course. Don't confuse this savings target with the decline in federal deficits that has occurred coming out of the recession. This estimate has nothing to do with recessions or recoveries. This is the permanent reduction in the gap between the trajectory of spending and revenues from where they are projected to go today. There are essentially three ways to achieve this. The first is to raise taxes substantially to levels significantly above their long-term post-war average. The second is to restructure the entitlement programs, making major changes in the kinds of benefits that older Americans receive. The third option is to substantially reduce the role of federal government in everything else it does, from national security to farm support. Let me give you an idea of the size of some of these changes. If we did nothing but raise taxes, increases would have to be about a sixth of what we're paying today. For all this extra pain, we get nothing more than simply the ability to keep funding the status quo. If all the changes occurred just in Social Security and Medicare, the cuts would amount to about a quarter of the total spending on those programs. We all know that our federal tax system is a mess, and raising these taxes in the existing system just makes all of its warts worse. But to give you an idea of the magnitude of tax changes needed to balance our books on an ongoing basis, let me tick off some possible changes for personal income taxes. Eliminate the mortgage interest deduction. Eliminate the deduction for state and local taxes. Raise tax rates on those earning $250,000 or more. Not pleasant, but CBO estimates that even enacting all three of these unpopular changes would raise less than half the extra revenue needed. Or how about these changes to entitlements? Raise the Medicare eligibility age to 67. Raise the Social Security age to 70. Link cost of living adjustments to a more slowly growing price index. Convert Medicaid payments to states and block grants. Increase Medicare Part B premiums. All these changes hurt older Americans, but help address the funding imbalances. But the truth is that all of them taken together only get us part of the way where we need to go. To say that our political leadership has failed to address this problem would be an understatement. Each of the last two administrations have managed to add new entitlements to the mix. We continue to engage in poisonous or misleading rhetoric, referring to reform proposals as heartless or radical, and suggesting that tiny, painless changes can solve the problem. Older Americans will scream foul, and it's hard to blame them. But it's fair to say that unthinking support we've given these universal entitlements does need to be rethought, no matter how unfair or heartless that might appear, because the problems in funding them are coming home to roost. The good news is that the imbalance is solvable if we would only find the courage to face it honestly. As the economist Herbert Stein famously once said, things that can't go on forever usually don't. I'm Patrick Barkey of the Bureau of Business and Economic Research.
Patrick Barkey is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.